Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to explore the cancer-killing properties of the pepper plant. We're also going to look at a common antioxidant that may guard against liver disease, according to a very important study, University of Colorado. We're also going to look at the sugar-free and diet drinks. Well, they're supposed to be healthier, especially if you're trying to lose weight. They are not, according to Imperial College London. We'll get into that. And we're also going to look at how witnessing fear in others can physically change our brains. Virginia Tech Research Institute on that. And then vitamin D deficiency increases the risk of chronic headaches, University of Eastern Finland, and more. I'm going to also today continue with the fake news. What's the truth behind the stories? We're going to explore the white helmet controversy because it looks like most of the liberal media has been major supporters of it. Question is, have they done their homework? And if they would have done independent research, would they have still held a supportive position? Rick Sterling from Consortium News does exactly that. Closer look. Also, we have an audio clip of someone who was in Aleppo. Now that it's been liberated, and all, do we get a completely different story from all the residents there about who the white helmets really are, what they really did. And also for those of you who are shocked, and rightly so, by some of the xenophobic statements of people in power, who do you think one of the most influential racist and white supremacists in world history was? I'll save that for you and show you that a man who is revered, loved, and respected was just a blatant racist, caused the death of millions of people, and should not be praised. Again, that all about him was fake news. The truth is a different story. Also today, students with nowhere to stay, homeless on college campuses. And we'll take a look at what's going on here. You're not supposed to be homeless or starving on a college campus, but they are. Big numbers. A special investigation from Truth Out with Eleanor Abatter. First up, we want to look at the latest on health and healing as we do every day because all over the world people are wanting to live longer and healthier lives. Researchers at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center have uncovered the chemical process behind the anti-cancer properties of a spicy Indian pepper plant called the long pepper, L-O-N-G-P-E-P-P-E-R. Now, this has been known in India for a long time. It's been used in Ayurvedic medicine for thousands of years. And we're observing things in other countries, but we like to know what's the science behind it. So using X-ray crystallography, they were able to create molecular structures that show how the chemical from the pepper is transformed after being ingested and what it does against cancer cells. It will not hurt healthy cells, but it does kill cancer cells. So for all of you who have been using hot peppers, and this was published in the Journal of Biological Chemistry, knowing they help thin your blood, helping prevent a stroke, yes. Help heal ulcers, yes. Help turn off pain in your joints, absolutely, in your muscles, accordingly. And helping with headaches, ditto to that. Now you can add killing cancer cells in the body. So everyone should be aware of that. That's important. And from the University of Colorado, a common antioxidant found in, well, it's found in human breast milk, but you can find it in kiwis. And it's good to take like 3 kiwis, put them in a blender. You're going to get a chemical out of that that is good against non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, which is huge. We're talking about upwards of 40 million Americans suffer from this. Why? Because the high fructose corn syrup is the primary contributor. Again, the liver is mainly adversely affected by viruses like hepatitis, but also by alcohol. So when neither viruses or alcohol are at work, what's then causing all this disease with the liver? It's high sugar in the diet. So what comes to the rescue? PQQ. Now, PQQ is a particular antioxidant. It's found in some fruits. High up on that list would be the kiwi. And it's terrific for your liver, for any type of liver. But in this case, they were specifically studying this to see what it would do with fatty liver disease. And the results were published in the Journal of the Federation of American Societies of Experimental Biology. And it's the first to demonstrate that PQQ can protect offspring of obese mothers from acceleration of obesity-induced liver disease. But it also is very, very good at helping the liver. How much do you need? Anywhere between 10 to 20 milligrams a day. That's a small amount. For a long time now, probably 40 years, we've been told, if you want to lose weight, well, go on the sugar-free diets. And more often than not, they're taking in sodas and different confections that don't have sugar, but have artificial sweeteners or diet drinks. Well, according to the Imperial College of London, quote, sugar-free and diet drinks are often seen as the healthier option, but researchers from Imperial College London have argued that they are no more helpful for maintaining a healthy weight than their full sugar versions. And so that is a surprise. And this was research at two different universities that came up with this. So my suggestion is this. Stay away from all artificial sweeteners. And if you want to lower the caloric intake, but still have something sweetened, use stevia. Now stevia comes in so many flavors. If you want a French vanilla flavor, if you want, let's say, a tangy lemon-lime flavor, it comes in a full spectrum. Has zero calories. It actually has medicinal value. And it's about 500 times sweeter than sugar. So people are eating a lot of fat in sugar-free foods. And also, that doesn't mean because it's sugar-free that it's healthy. You could have something that doesn't have sugar, as in sucrose or glucose or fructose, but you could have lots of gluten, trans fatty acids, and saturated fats, and have it heavily baked or cooked or fried. So just stay away from them. Also, they have found that a natural enzyme could protect against a type of colorectal cancer by suppressing tumors. This is in Georgia State University and published in the journal OncoTarget. And that's important. I posted this article on my website. It's a little more technical than most people could understand who don't have a science background, but it's just showing enzymes. Now, I take it to a larger point of view. We know that enzymes of all type, let's say bromelain and papain, papaya is your papain, bromelain is from pineapple. I'll just use those two as an example. But every single food you consume has enzymes in it. Plant-based, every nut, every seed, every legume, herb, etc. But these are the heavy-duty industrial strength enzymes. And the most is inside the core of the pineapple. And that's what no one ever eats. It's too pithy. It's too chewy. They like the more fleshy, sweet part on the outside. So if you go to a store where they're selling cubed pineapple, ask them to save it for you. And if you have a nice store person, they will. This way you don't even have to buy it. In any case, inside there are these enzymes. And the enzymes are literally the catalysts of life. They're the spark plugs inside of a body. So the more enzymes you have, the healthier you're going to be. The easier it is to break down food in the stomach. For example, amylase, lipase, pepsin, these are all in the enzyme family to break down fats, carbohydrates, and proteins into smaller and smaller particles so your body can ultimately make them into what is called chyme, C-H-Y-M-E, which is like a thick soup. And once the body has digested everything like a thick soup, then it goes in the intestine, and then those individual little molecules can be absorbed through the jejunum and then taken into the body, taken to, through the liver, where they're metabolized and then taken out to the cells. If you have enzyme-rich foods or you have digestive enzymes after a meal, it facilitates better digestion. But enzymes are also important in turning off inflammation in the body. And that's why, historically, enzymes from pineapple and enzymes from papaya have been used for arthritis, bursitis, tendonitis, and they work. So that's the takeaway message from that. And also, from University of Virginia Tech Research Institute, published in the American College of Neuropsychopharmacology's journal, if you watch someone else who is fear, that can change your brain. Now, just imagine people living in environments where there's a great deal of fear. Fear of being, let's say, fired, fear of having to compete with other people, whatever the fear may be. It may be real or exaggerated, or not at all. But fear changes our own brains. Here's what they say, quote, negative emotional experience leaves a trace in the brain, which makes us more vulnerable. Any form of traumatic experience, even those without physical pain, are a risk factor for mental disorders, hence post-traumatic stress disorder, or also called PTSD, is an anxiety disorder that can develop in some people after they've experienced a shocking or scary or a dangerous event. And most people who live through dangerous events don't develop the disorder. But about 8% of people do. And they're the ones that end up with some form of post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, I've produced and directed and written 3 documentaries on veterans. The latest is American Veterans Forgotten and Betrayed. I've interviewed over 1,000 one-on-one. And the one thing they say, including guys from Vietnam and men and women from Iraq, is that when they go home, almost anything can upset them. Just normal activities. And they also have a hard time dealing with any form of conflict. Because in a theater of war, where you don't know if the person walking down the street is going to detonate a bomb and kill you, and you've seen everyone in a theater of war sees the casualties and sees those injured, and it creates trauma. So when I ask them, did you ever think what it is to be the person living in that area where whose home is broken into, where they go to sleep not knowing will their home be broken into because they have a son who's 14, and any son over the age of 10 is fair game. They'll break into the homes screaming and flashing lights, guns at the ready, and they've killed people, completely innocent, harmless people. Could you imagine what that's like? And you got to go home after your tour of duty. That is their home. Now imagine that around the world, right now in conflict zones. You're dealing with 38 million people in Iraq. You're dealing with at least 7 million in Syria. And I went around, I just counted the countries, and you're dealing with over 50 million people are being affected. And many of those, especially younger people, are going to spend the rest of their life with post-traumatic stress disorder. That's the legacy that we leave when we don't pay attention to what we do, nor do we challenge the rightness of it, especially if you're a good Democrat or good Republican. Whatever is done in your name, you don't care. If you're a good progressive, you damn well do care. And if you're a true and authentic, let's say, liberal or conservative, you do care. You don't want anyone doing anything against other people that was not necessary. That brings me to this. This is our history lesson on the truth behind the fake news. When I watch, and I do, I'll watch a program to see where they're going with the truth. And in the vast majority of cases, they exchange bits, parts, or whole of the truth for fake news. I'll give you an example. We like to believe that we're exceptional. And in many respects, we have been historically. But did you know, and this is completely documented, that America has been at war 93% of our entire time since 1776. That means that 222 out of 239 years, we've been in conflict. And all you have to do is go back and ask, gee whiz, why? Then surely that's not remarkable. You know, people should not pride themselves on their ability to coexist, their ability to understand how to use detente and true diplomacy if they're always fighting. But it's a fact. Pick any year since 1776, and there's a 91% chance that America was involved in a war that year or conflict. I'll just give you some to give you an example of this. Of course, in 1776, we had the American Revolutionary War, but we also had other wars. We had the Second Cherokee War. We had the Panamite-Yankee War, and we also had the Chickamauga Wars. And those all continued right up through 1785. Then we had no longer the American Revolutionary War, and we no longer had the Panamite and Yankee War, but we had the Northwest Indian Wars and the Osage Wars and also the Chickamauga Wars. And those lasted for another 7 to 10 years. And then we had the Northwest Indian War in 1795. We only had 2 years without war in that whole period. And that was 1796 and 1797. And then we had what was called the Quasi War, and that lasted 3 years. Then we had the First Barbary War, and that lasted 6 years. And then we had the Sabine, and that was a year. And then in 1810, the U.S. occupied the Spanish-held West Florida, and that was 1710. Then we had the Tecumseh War in 1811, and we also had the Seminole War starting in 1812. And then we occupy the Amelia Islands and other parts of eastern Florida. And we had the War of 1812 that lasted 4 years. And then we had the First Seminole War, 1816, and that went on and off for over 40 years. So I look here and I look at the Sac and Fox Indian War of 1831 and the Black Hawk War of 1832 and the Cherokee Indian War of 1833. And then in 1834, 5, and 6, we had the Cherokee Indian War, the Pawnee Indian Territory Campaign and War, and the Second Creek War, and the Missouri-Iowa Border Wars. And these went on for almost, well, up until about 1839. Then once again, we had the U.S. Navy invade the Fiji Islands, and then we had the Seminole Wars in 1840 and 1841 and 1842, and then the U.S. forces go into China, and then we also invade the African coast. Then we had the 1844 Texas Indian Wars, 1845 Texas Indian Wars, the Mexican-American War in 1846, continuing the Texas Indian Wars in 46 and 47 and 48. And then we had the Cayuse War and the Navajo Wars and in 1849. So every single year we had wars, sometimes 4, 5, 6 wars going on, and yet the average person's not aware of this. So the next time someone tells you, yeah, we're a peace-loving country, we believe in democracy, freedom, and no, we don't, and we never have at any time, except for those few years We have always been a country that has sought, through hegemony, power over others, regime change, manipulation, almost always because it serves someone's political, ideological, or more often than not, economic interest. So we're just going to continue. When they say we've got the truth, we're going to challenge their truth. And finally, I believe that we should be using meditation on a daily basis. It's one way that no matter how crazy the world seems, how difficult times may be, concerning what opportunities we've missed or don't have, the circumstances we now find ourselves in, I counsel people every day who just can't handle the idea that they don't look the same, they don't feel the same, they never thought about their health because they never had obvious diseases, and now they do. And now it's sagging, bagging. They're in pain, they're fatigued, they're limited. Many of the previous joys are gone. And so one of the ideas that I try to get them to begin to embrace is an awful lot can be remedied if we meditate. Now, there was a good article in the Herald Mail about meditation. And it's suggesting here, quote, 43% of all adults suffer from adverse health from stress. 75 to 90% of all doctor office visits are for stress-related ailments and complaints. That's according to WebMD. Americans spend $300 billion annually on stress. And modern medicine and ancient Eastern wisdom agree that meditation, and it doesn't take long, 10 to 15 minutes a day. It can reduce and help you manage your stress because you can start to do simple things when we're stressed. You can begin to realize that it's really not about you. And it was Herbert Benson who I interviewed on this program. He's the Harvard Medical physician who coined the phrase the relaxation response, essentially the opposite of fight or flight, meaning this response in the body activated by deep breathing and relaxing muscles and slowing your heart rate and decreasing your blood pressure and releasing healing hormones like DHEA and melatonin, serotonin, human growth hormone, can only happen when you take a moment and breathe deep. So what you do is this. You simply find a quiet place, wherever that may be. Just sit quietly with your eyes closed. Put your hands in your lap and do deep diaphragmatic breathing about 30 times. Slow in and out. And suddenly you find yourself, wow, you're not tense in your neck. Your shoulders and back feel more relaxed. And just taking that deep breath. Remember when you were growing up, if you had a mom like mine, and most of you had a mom like mine, we all have mothers who had similar ways of dealing with issues. Count to 10. Okay, so you're thinking, I don't want to count to 10. I'm angry about something. Count to 10. So you just count slowly. No, slow it down. Now when you're counting, breathe. Between each breath, count. And suddenly we weren't as anxious or upset. Also, we now know that when you meditate, you increase your DHEA levels. That's the master hormone in your body. And that corresponds to a 48% reduction in more death due to cardiovascular disease and a 36% reduction in death overall when you increase your DHEA levels in the blood. And meditation helps you do that. Of course, you can also take about 20 milligrams DHEA, it helps as well. But melatonin, getting that good night's sleep, improves your mood, improves anti-aging in the body. And also, Blaise Pascal, the French mathematician, physicist, inventor, who said, all men's miseries derive from not being able to sit in a quiet room alone. So this helps the men in this audience. Meditation is going to relax your body, calms your mind. and that allows you to see things more clearly, make better choices, more appropriate responses, use reason instead of reaction, and it's good for you. That's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. To welcome all of you. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to begin sharing a different perspective. We're going to take some of these current urban legends that are promoted and show you that there is another side to the story. You'll then have an opportunity to judge which one you want to believe in, one or the other or neither, but at least you'll know there is another story. And I'm going to share some information from Rick Sterling from Consortium News, and it's about the White Helmets. Here's what he says. Across the mainstream Western media, the White Helmets are hailed as heroic first responders, rescuing injured civilians in rebel-controlled parts of Syria. The UK Guardian and The Independent urged the Nobel Committee to award this year's Nobel Peace Prize to the White Helmets. As it turns out, they didn't get that one, but they did receive the prestigious Right Livelihood Award, which is the alternative. On the U.S. side of the Atlantic, the White Helmets are treated with similar uncritical acclaim. They were the subject of an October 17th Time magazine cover story. Netflix has released a special documentary movie about them. New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof has gushed over them for years, helping the group's one-sided depiction of events inside Syria shape the pro-rebel narrative that is pretty much all the American and European public hear about Syria. And this love fest is not just confined to established media. Democracy Now! Ran a puff piece interview with the White Helmet infomercial directors. The Intercept published an uncritical promotion of the White Helmets, and the group's controversial leader, and Code Pink, recommended the Netflix movie, though after receiving criticism about it, the endorsement, the anti-war group removed it. Yet despite the favorable group thing regarding the White Helmets and more broadly about the rebel cause in Syria, there's another side to this story, including the fact that the White Helmets are not just some well-meaning Syrians who emerged to help all civilians suffering from the 5 years of war. Not only do they only operate in rebel-controlled areas, but they are a source of propaganda about the war. Indeed, their very existence is an element in the larger propaganda campaign to rally international support for a regime change war in Syria. The White Helmets brand was conceived and directed by a New York-based marketing company named Syria Campaign, which itself was incubated by a larger political-oriented marketing company called Purpose. Along with, and by the way, they received about $100 million from the United States government. $100 million to the White Helmets. And along with managing the online and social media promotion of the White Helmets, the Syrian campaign has parallel efforts to support the regime change in Syria. One of these efforts has been to criticize United Nations and humanitarian relief organizations that supply aid to displaced persons living in areas protected by the Syrian government. Quote, the allegations made by the Syrian campaign and others were written by people who know nothing about the UN and how it must work, according to a worker in Damascus. And then they have all these exaggerated claims. They claimed all they saved 65,000 people. Not true. The area served by the White Helmets and controlled by Al-Qaeda's al-Nusra Front and its rebel allies have very few civilians living in them. A medical doctor visiting East Aleppo described it as a, quote, ghost town. Yet Western media reports cite a highly inflated estimate of 250,000 people. That's simply propaganda, all lies. Perhaps unintentionally, the White Helmets and one of its video teams confirmed this reality in producing a cat video when cat videos were all the rage on social media. In an apparent bid to bring cat lovers onto the side of regime change in Syria, the White Helmets video showed White Helmet members playing with stray cats in empty neighborhoods, saying, quote, on camera, this is the White Helmets. The homeowners abandoned this district and its kittens. Besides promoting themselves as a humanitarian group, the White Helmets have become essential to the propaganda war by gaining, along with similar pro-rebel activists, a virtual monopoly on the information from rebel-controlled areas, supplying a steady stream of heart-rending stories and images about suffering children to a credulous Western media, wanting to believe everything bad about the Syrian government. One of the reasons why the White Helmets have been so successful in inserting their propaganda in Western media is that most of the rebel zones in Syria, especially East Aleppo, have been off limits to Western journalists and other outside observers for years. Two of the last Western reporters to venture into rebel territory, James Foley and Stephen Sotloff, were subsequently beheaded by the Islamic State in those areas. So as the Syrian government and its allies finally try to expel, which they now have, al-Qaeda terrorists and their cohorts from eastern Aleppo, the White Helmets have become a major source for the Western news media, which treats these relief workers as credible providers on the ground information. They are not. True, the positive image of the White Helmets and the group's skillful use of social media deflect attention from the sectarian, violent, and unpopular nature of al-Qaeda's Nusra Front, of which they work with. In other words, the White Helmets have gone from being talked about to being the ones doing the talking. News stories increasingly use White Helmet witnesses as their sources, often in ways that promote the self-serving myth of White Helmet heroism. One day, CNN announced that a White Helmet aid center had been hit. Another day, Time magazine claimed the White Helmet workers were being hunted. Reports from the White Helmets have also served as eyewitness accounts, but only one side eyewitness, the terrorist eyewitness, about the Syrian military. And it goes on to talk about how when you actually get people like Max Blumenthal, who wrote a two-part excellent expose on at Alternet, quote, how the White Helmets became international heroes while pushing U.S. intervention and regime change in Syria, as well as another article inside the shadowy PR firm that's lobbying for regime change in Syria. But you don't see that. You don't see Max on television, and you don't see him when using that story. So that's part of this. And also, you don't hear from Vanessa Beeley. We have a segment we're going to do on an upcoming show where she exposes the White Helmets. And they are not the true Syrian defense, civil defense. The real Syrian civil defense works on a shoestring budget, with real volunteers, without video teams accompanying and promoting them. And most in the West are unaware the real Syrian defense even exists. The situation is similar for the Syrian Arab Red Crescent, which is a genuinely neutral and independent relief organization that has a good website. And another online petition, also at change.org, which is still up and running, calls for the Right Livelihood Foundation to rescind its award to the White Helmets. So you have been lied to. You have been used. And by the way, the very same people who conned you into believing that in North Africa's most advanced country of all the 54 countries in Africa, Libya, longest lifespan, highest educated literate rate. Best conditions for women in any country in the world, where you have Arabs, that he was a demon and he was killing his own civilians in Benghazi. It wasn't true. It was all lies. Just like it was lies when the daughter of the ambassador to Kuwait was crying, saying all the Iraqi soldiers threw the babies out of the incubators in Kuwait to take the incubators. Not true. It was all a lie. All in Saddam Hussein as a weapons master. It lies. So what point do we finally get it that we're being lied to by the same people who are always engaged in some form of regime change? And when do we stand up and do our own investigative reporting, as Max Blumenthal, to his credit, did? but not Democracy Now. Don't be a puppet. Allow your forum to be used for propagandizing, where thousands of people are going to be slaughtered. That isn't cool. Even if you're on the liberal side, ideologically, of an issue. Since when does a death caused by negligence, malfeasance, or foolishness become justified because you're a liberal?
Being gluten intolerant is the hottest eating trend in the New Age community since we found out you don't have to eat animals. Gluten is the new animal you don't have to eat. Being gluten intolerant used to be limited only to those who are actually intolerant to gluten. But with the cutting-edge information I'm sharing with you in this video, you too can be gluten intolerant, regardless if you're truly intolerant to gluten or not. Being gluten intolerant is a fantastic opportunity for you to assert your dominance on the lives of everyone around you, which helps improve your life. So if you're ready to have a ravenous appetite for impossible standards and dogmatic feelings of victimization, then let's get started on what you need to do to become gluten intolerant. Be restaurant savvy. Go to regular restaurants and order. After they've brought you exactly what you've ordered, you discover there's gluten in it. This is the exact time you'll want to profess your gluten-free morals to the waiter. Is there gluten in that pizza?
Yes.
I didn't know that when I ordered it. I can't eat that. I'm gluten intolerant. It's a condition. You're going to have to take that back. Tell people about your most disgusting bodily functions. Being gluten intolerant means you're entitled to tell people about the offensive things that happen to you if you eat gluten. Because they're not gluten-free, they're obligated by law to listen. I would get diarrhea on the spot. I mean, I would literally explode right now if I ate any gluten. Then I'd have bloody diarrhea every day. No, I said bloody diarrhea. What do you think I said? These don't have any gluten in them, do they? I'm starting to get a headache. I think those had gluten in them. Give expert medical advice. Once you take your gluten-free vows, you'll need to have an automatic understanding that every medical condition is caused by gluten. Depression, it's always caused by gluten. Obesity, that's 100% gluten. Every single case of cancer is caused by gluten. I swear, gluten's what killed Gandhi. Never let anyone's efforts be good enough for you. If you're at a friend's house and they've gone out of their way and think they've met the Da Vinci Code of your gluten-free demands, they're not trying to be friendly. They're trying to overthrow your reign of control and dominance. You can't let this happen. You'll want to play the trump card of another food intolerance that you've never told them about before. This puts you back in the driver's seat.
This is all 100% gluten-free.
That's so nice of you. Thank you. It doesn't have any dairy in it, does it? Because I can't eat dairy either. Know your nutritional facts. Since being gluten-free is a nutritional philosophy based entirely on what not to eat, you don't know what you're actually supposed to eat. This means you have zero knowledge of what good nutrition actually is. But don't worry about that. To fill this small little loophole, you'll need to preach with conviction that anything that has no gluten in it is healthy for you.
Want some? You're gluten-free. You need as many as you want. So good for you. Don't I look more vibrant from these? I feel like my bones are getting stronger.
Pretend to enjoy gluten-free alternatives. Let's say you find a new gluten-free bread. How are you supposed to enjoy this coagulation of mysterious flowers that form a brick with the density of a black hole in the dryness of a desert? Answer, you're not. You're supposed to pretend to. This is like paying your membership dues to belong to the high society of being gluten intolerant.
How is it?
It's enjoyable. Can I grab a glass of water?
Condescendingly enjoy new gluten discoveries. When you learn of a new food that has trace amounts of gluten in it, enjoy the renewed sense of purpose that floods into your life while you sit on top of your moral high ground made out of rice flour. Did you know now they're putting gluten in potato chips? I didn't know that. Glad I'm informed. Seclusion makes gluten healthier. Understand that when no one's around, you somehow become less gluten intolerant. How does this happen? Well, based on medical evidence that's yet to be discovered, there's a direct correlation between how many people are around and how gluten intolerant you are. Continuously read books that advocate a gluten-free lifestyle. You do this even though you know the plot, moral of the story, and how the book ends before you even start it. You'll want to avidly stay abreast on how the latest author takes 300 pages to say, don't eat gluten.
It's such a good book, and I can't wait to get to all these.
Rave about your results. At this point, you're just mindlessly reciting the results you've had since you've been gluten-free so that you can justify your nutritional dogma. What if you haven't seen any improvements? No problem, just make some up. Nobody will know the difference or care. My abs have gotten razor sharp since I've been gluten-free. Big time. I mean, seriously. I don't know if this is from no gluten or if you Photoshop these things onto me. At this point, you're armed to live a good life being gluten intolerant. Enjoy. My head hurts so bad. I think there was definitely gluten in those chips.
I'm very concerned about many of the students in America who already have crippling debt. And of course, when you add in the interest and the fact that most won't be able to pay it all at once, then you're looking at debt that could go on for decades. But according to Truthout, Eleanor Bader, students also have frequently nowhere to stay. Homelessness on college campuses. I'd like to share what she says here. She says that the number of 20 million students presently enrolled in both undergraduate and graduate study, and they're talking about that a lot of these individuals are simply so poor that they are, quote, experiencing food insecurity and homelessness. Quote, most students think of homelessness as being on the street, sleeping in doorways, or for the most part, college students don't do this. They hide out. They may stay in one place for a few days or a week, then move somewhere else, bouncing from friend to friend with no fixed place to stay. But they think to themselves, well, this is college. As long as I have a roof over my head, I'm okay. If that roof happens to be in a tent, subway, car, or vehicle, so be it. As Fan Chan notes, a person who's executive director of UAccess at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, that provides some on-campus support to students who are experiencing food insecurity and homelessness, that this is very common. Students typically do their damnedest to make do, showering in the gym and visiting the emergency food pantries that are increasingly popping up on U.S. campuses. What are the causes of student homelessness? Sarah Rabb, a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, has been studying college affordability and its connection to retention since 2008. Her initial research involved analyzing the impact of the Fund for Wisconsin Scholars. Quote, my team went out to get the lay of the land from students and asked them how was it going paying for college. We expected to hear them tell us that they were having trouble affording their books or buying a laptop. But what we heard was food insecurity. One student told us that she was living in a shelter. This stunned us. We had to ask whether this was happening on a larger scale. Shortly thereafter, Rab's team interviewed 4,300 students at 10 geographically diverse community colleges. In parsing the results, they discovered that homeless and hunger in students were a varied lot. Some had not had enough to eat or had been homeless throughout their childhood. Some had aged out of foster care and had no family to turn to. And some had fallen out with their parents or guardians or had their family ties altered by deportation or incarceration. Another cohort had grossly underestimated the cost of college and come up short. And lastly, Rab found students living with a host of mental illnesses. For some, completing coursework while living independently proved nearly impossible. Let's give an example. There's a Daniela, 29, a student at the City University of New York, and who knows about homelessness firsthand. Daniela was living in Florida with her infant son in 2008 when she lost her job as a telemarketer, and unemployment benefits carried her into 2009. But when they were exhausted, she fell behind on her rent and received an eviction notice. She'd grown up in New York, so she opted to head north, crossing her fingers that there would be an opportunity for her in the Big Apple. She immediately went to social services and was given a subsidized apartment in Far Rockaway, Queens, paid for through a voucher program. Quote, I got a job as a cashier, and my children, by then, I'd given birth to my daughter, so I had two kids and were in daycare. Things were good until 2012 when the mayor ended the voucher program and I ended up back in the shelter system. This time I was sent to the Bronx. I tried to commute to my job, but it took 3 hours to get there by subway, so I had to quit. By then, she joined an organization called Picture the Homeless. They taught me how to be an advocate and helped me enroll in college. But from 2012 until Christmas 2015, my kids and I lived in a shelter. The challenges were enormous. Not only was she required to attend shelter meetings that conflicted with her classes, but also she and her children were crammed into a room that she described as small, moldy, rodent-infested, and noisy. On top of this, there was nowhere for her to do her homework or study. Quote, I had to squeeze my assignments in between classes, she said, and for the most part, she added, her teachers have been supportive. I always tell them what's going on, and most have gone above and beyond to inspire and motivate me, helping me with the time management so I don't fall behind. It's worked. She expects to earn her associate's degree this year, and she and her kids now live in an apartment near the college. And if all goes according to plan, she'll enroll in a bachelor program next spring. Nonetheless, she anticipates bumps and obstacles. So we have to understand that private colleges are ill-equipped to help people. The states are not even aware of it. It's not on anyone's major radar. So the issue is this. We have an awful lot. We're talking about several million kids in college who, for one reason or another, they didn't anticipate all the expenses and they don't have a good support system. So they still want to get that college education, which is important to them in their future. So they simply adapt to whatever they have to do. So if they have to go to the gym to shower, they have to go to the homeless food pantry to get some food. They can sleep on couches, couch surfing with friends, whatever it takes, or sleeping in a city shelter. I remember when I went to school, first a private college in West Virginia, Mountain State Business College, but then later at State College in New Jersey and graduate studies. College was not expensive. Graduate school was. Getting a doctor can easily run you $100,000 to $300,000, but getting through basic education was not that expensive. Today, it's extremely expensive, and there are fewer jobs when a person gets out. Almost 55% of all graduates with a BA degree go home and live with their parents because there's just no job for them, unless it's menial work or service work, working as a waiter or bartender. I think that if we simply forgave all student debt and made all state schools, state colleges, and community colleges free for tuition, they would pay for their books and room and board and food, but tuition would be free. Think of how that would help so many students. And also, we're going to have fewer people then in dire poverty needing subsidies. And they're better able to get their degrees and go on and, and try to find work. If we gave Wall Street, and these are not nice people by any measure, we gave them handouts to the tune of over $21 trillion. We took away all their bad loans, their bad debts. We cleaned up their balance sheets. Then we could find $1.3 trillion to forgive all student debt, if we chose to. I just hope that we come to that point where we choose to. Now, let's hear from someone who has something to say about gluten. I'm sure many people listening right now have had an awakening when it comes to the power of conscious choice, where you just don't want that gluten. Well, Mr. Sears has some thoughts. Please listen in. Well, that's a different perspective. We're out of time. I want to thank you all for taking your time to listen in. And please go to progressiveradionetwork.com or prn.fm, because every day, dozens to hundreds of articles on progressive themes are posted, documentaries, investigative reports, calls to action from all over the world. So every day, if you want to see what's going on in the world and solutions to these issues, you can find it on our website. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you for listening and have a nice day.
Have lots of fancy clothes and drive a big fine Cadillac, not knowing all the time I had these things. My friends were stabbing me straight in my back. No, 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 even had a house there out there in Beverly Hills. I was moving so fast, y'all, I didn't even have time to worry about paying my bills. I used to have lots of money. I had them in big old stacks. I used to lend them my clothes, but they never, never, ever, never, never brought them back.
Now I don't have nothing.
I'm so all alone.
Even have a home.
I ain't got no place to lay my head.
Wish someone would help me.
And I used to come out of the bottom of my heart, because I thought you were a friend of mine. But it seemed that you didn't even give a damn.